Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we learn about a husband and wife circus duo, hear about the increasing popularity of vinyl records, the surge of Illinois wines, and we talk to the granddaughter of Raggedy Ann creator Johnny Gruel about the closing of the Raggedy Ann and Andy Museum in Arcola. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. For most of us, a circus big top means cotton candy and clowns. For Shane and Alicia Hansen, a husband and wife duo known as the Rolling Diamonds, the circus is another day at the office.
I wear a costume that's it's kind of like a bathing suit. It's open in the back.
We always have matching costumes when we're on stage.
My favorite one is black velvet on the bottom with pink on the top that has silver squares that shine and reflect, and then I have rhinestones.
I have black pants. They're like spandex, but they're not real tight. They're loose spandex.
As long as they don't come off my boobs or show my boobs, then I'm fine.
My name is Alicia Hansen, and I am part of the Rolling Diamonds acrobatic roller skating, and I skate with my husband Shane Hansen, and we travel in the circus with our two little girls, Olivia, who's 4, and Madison, who's 2.
My name is Shane Hansen. We travel about 9 months a year. We go from sea to shining sea, I guess.
He always tells me how much she loves me right before we get up on the platform.
Yeah, so you won't drop me.
Yeah, if we're in a big fight. Everything's okay, honey. Okay. Yeah, all right, how do you feel? All right, give me a kiss. Love you.
Yeah. Love you. And now,
performing full routine.
Okay.
Angel to start. You got the both neck spins on?
Yes.
All right. Angel.
We start spinning and then he says hup and we go into a trick.
Hup.
That means I know he's ready. He's up to this proper speed and we can go into the trick.
Hup. And hup.
And we wear roller skates. I put my legs up behind my husband's neck and we're just spinning around like that.
My wife does the tricks, but I'm the one that's skating in circles constantly the whole time. I have to hold my wife up. I skate in circles while she does the tricks, so what I have to focus on is staying on the table itself. Just gotta let her do her thing while I'm kind of being the bottom person.
My husband has the, I say, most difficult part because he's gotta keep skating the whole time and not go off the edge and fall, which he's never done. My part is to do the actual tricks.
Good airplane. Up.
If we are in a fight and we have to work, you still have to smile and act like everything's great. And with the skating, you kind of have that centrifugal force. So if you want to just let me go fly off the skating platform, then he would go too because he'd go the other way. Luckily, we don't fight that often. You have that kind of flow where he'll go to make one move and I'll say, oh, I know what he's going to do.
Hop. And hop.
I grew up in the circus with my family, and my family did the flying trapeze. I started performing when I was 9. My older sister was 9. She started performing, and my younger sister was 9. She started performing. Not that 9's a magical age, but that's when my dad figured that we were ready to actually perform. And we grew up traveling, and we homeschooled, and that's how we got our schooling. And when we would learn about Mount Rushmore, might be driving by it, and we'd stop and say, oh, look, that's what I'm learning in my book, or the Grand Canyon, or where the Civil War was fought, and the Alamo, and all those places. I've been, I think, to pretty much everywhere.
I grew up, my parents were in circus before I was born. I was born into it. I hope I don't have to do anything else for the rest of my life.
because I love this life.
Woo! Yeah! Good one, honey. Up. Up.
I've been skating for so long, like that. Well, it's almost like walking to me. I've been doing it since I was 3 years old. I slip up there, I stumble a little bit, but my reaction to get back on track, it's so quick. I've just been doing it for so long. It's a lot of fun. Definitely a lot of fun.
Yeah! Huh. Huh.
You have to have a lot of trust in this. You gotta trust one another.
So you have to trust that he's not gonna fall or do something wrong, and I have to trust that he's not gonna let me go.
Because if the other one wasn't there, then we wouldn't have an act. Or it'd be a really lame act. I'd just spin around by myself. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know how many people would want to see that for too long. You are good looking, but I don't know.
Not getting $3. Not getting only $3.
That feature was produced by Paula Morrow while she was a student at the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. This is Sidetrack. Digital music players are common today. The ability to store an entire music catalog in a device no bigger than the palm of your hand has proven to be popular. But not everyone has jumped onto the digital bandwagon. From Macomb, Joseph Wagner reports.
It's a sound familiar to digital music fans. The click of an iPod scrolling for the right song. But some music fans embrace another sound. A stylist on a vinyl record. The old LP format is making a comeback, and it just might help the music industry. It's hard to say when vinyl began regaining popularity, but ask any vinyl enthusiast, and they'll let you know.
Never really died off in, as far as an underground level goes.
Virgil Dickerson is the owner of Colorado-based Suburban Home Records, which specializes in punk and folk rock. He also operates Vinyl Collective, which is an online store for, you guessed it, vinyl. Dickerson has been running Vinyl Collective for more than 3 years. Recently, he's seen a growth in sales.
Over the last maybe year, I've just noticed just an explosion. I think I would say probably the last year and a half, I've seen just a huge growth in vinyl sales.
This explosion in vinyl sales seemed to catch most of the music industry off guard. Music labels are now reissuing their back catalogs on vinyl. Even though vinyl sales rocketed 89% from the year before, they still only account for a bit more than 1% of all music sales. But it's the 89% increase that has labels once again pressing old classics such as Abbey Road and Dark Side of the Moon. One reason music fans are moving to the old LP is the sound quality. Mike Murray is an assistant broadcasting professor at Western Illinois University. He says the MP3 format is just too perfect.
I think the thing that people hear when they hear a good analog setup is a presentation of sound that's easier on the ear. It's a little less compressed.
Digital audio files cover most of the sound spectrum. But to save space on a hard drive or portable device, they're compressed into smaller files, most commonly MP3s. The compression is what gives MP3s their tinny sound.
So what I think people are hearing is something that's a little, it's tailored more to the kinds of frequencies our ears are good at hearing, okay, which is a real sort of warm, smooth representation of the middle frequencies, kind of a natural roll-off of the high end. And then the low frequencies are pretty comparable to CD.
Sound is not the only reason people are going back to the LP. When MP3s are purchased or downloaded from the internet, it almost seems like nothing happened. The buyer has nothing physical to show for their purchase. For WIU music education major Douglas Kuzminoff, vinyl is just the opposite.
I like the idea of a needle picking up the vibrations. And the fact that, you know, a vinyl is so much bigger, it's like art, it is artwork. It's like a poster almost, you can hang it up on your wall.
The art, Kuzminoff adds, is the packaging of the vinyl as well.
And vinyls, you know, they come with, you know, better stuff. They'll come with like a huge lyric sheet, you know, the liner notes will be awesome. And you can get like colored vinyl, it's not just a piece of metal.
Mike Murray believes there's a feeling one gets when buying vinyl that simply is not there with MP3s.
You know, and MP3s are the same way. They're very handy, and you can get an entire catalog onto a little iPod or something like that, and that's great, but there's nothing to handle. You know, there's a certain sort of romance, a certain sort of gratification.
It's that gratification that is drawing people back to vinyl. In addition, most new LPs provide a bonus. They include a little square of paper with a code on it. This code allows the buyer to go online and download the album for free. This way the buyer not only has the record for home use, but the MP3 version for portable use. Dickerson feels without this free download, most record buyers would illegally download the music anyway.
You know, I don't think it's very fair to ask, especially in this economic climate, a music fan to purchase more than one version of the album. Thank you for
the record. This fairness is going over well with music fans. It's bridging the old technology with the new, and giving vinyl the look that it's here to stay. Again, Joseph Wagner reporting.
You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Backcountry ranger George Durkee and his wife Paige live nearly 4 months of each year in near total isolation in Kings Canyon, Sequoia National Park, in California's Sierra Nevada Mountains. At the beginning of each season, all their food is brought in by mule train, and it must last them until they leave camp in the fall. Independent producer Brad Horn hiked in to interview Durkee and recorded his journey.
It was a chilly July morning at a remote trailhead, high up in the southern Sierra Nevada. I was on the eastern edge of the range. 20 miles to the south was the tallest mountain in the continental United States, Mount Whitney, almost 15,000 feet high. I was hanging out with a mule packer.
Morning, guys. Right.
The packer had picked me up hitchhiking the day before, and I had to spend the night on the floor of his pack station, 13 miles from the nearest one-stoplight town. I was preparing for a backpacking trip. The five-day journey that lay before me would be tough, and even though those mules smelled like manure, I was daydreaming about riding one of them into the mountains instead of walking, since the trip ahead would require hiking over two passes, both almost 12,000 feet high. Such heights come as no surprise in the Sierra, but the last time I went backpacking, only 4 months earlier, I had hurt my knee and had to drag myself out of the backcountry. It was an excruciating 2 days of limping and screaming and crying. And that was in the Appalachians, a tame mountain range by most standards. The southern Sierra Nevadas, on the other hand, are a serious mountain range by any standard. They even look frightening, almost Martian, since their granite faces, sheer cliffs, and harsh weather prevent much plant growth. For my rolling hill, East Coast sensibilities, the Sierras are thrilling and very scary. But my goal was to interview a backcountry ranger about life in the middle of the wilderness. And the only way to get to the middle of the wilderness is to hike there.
So I am I'm sitting on the edge of the trail to Ray Lakes Ranger Station and just weighed my pack down at the pack station. And it's 54 pounds. That's a lot of weight, but it is beautiful and I'm happy to be here. And I'll check back in with you later when I'm screaming in pain. Oh, God. That was brutal. I just got to the top of Glen Pass, and it's really nice up here. Lots of snow. And it's July 10th, I think it is, so... That tells you how high it is. It's about 12,000 feet. There's some green lakes below. I can see Ray Lakes. At least I think it's Ray Lakes where I'm going. All right, well, that's all for now. So made it to Ray Lakes where I am now. And I'm going to interview George. It gave me a good excuse to comb my hair. And hopefully it'll be a good interview.
1934 Art, 1934 Kaminsky Gold.
George Jerky, backcountry ranger in Kings Canyon National Park. You know, I've been doing this 35 years, but for the last 20, my wife Paige has been coming in. We come back here and we stay for the whole 3 or 4 months of the summer and fall season. We bring in all of our food at once, so that kind of limits your choices to beans and rice and spaghetti. There's no phone. Cell phones don't even work here. I mean, living back here isn't easy, even for us. Although, I don't know, the positives well outweigh the negatives. But all of our food and everything comes in on mules, about eight mules for the whole season. For instance, this year, as the mules were crossing the river, one of them went down and went underwater, and the packer had just a major wreck. All the mules were thrashing around, and he was trying to get off his horse, and he was in serious danger himself, and cut the mule free. And to do that, he had to cut our supplies loose, and so they ended up sitting in the river for an hour. So we lost a fair amount of stuff there.
I was wondering, how has spending so much time in the backcountry affected your consciousness? Do you think when you go into cities, how do you feel maybe different than the people who are there?
The dichotomy used to be a lot more of a contrast for me. You go in and there's just so many choices. You've got lights, cars all around, and so on and so forth. Even looking at a menu was difficult. There were just so many choices on it. And talking to people when I'm actually, in the city, there's sort of this faint sense that they see me and all the backcountry rangers I work with feel approximately the same, that we're just aging hippies that we never grew up, and that someday we'll wake up and we'll get a real job and live in a cubicle somewhere. So far it hasn't obviously happened after 35 years.
So all right, day number 3 here. At this point, a pizza sounds really good. Eating an entire large pizza, that's the goal at this point. But anyway, I got 2 huge passes before then. So I'm on the way back down here. The first time I came out to the Sierra, you know, I thought no pain, no gain, and I gotta move fast and get this over with. But that's not the technique to use. As I've been informed, the technique to use is to call it conversational pace. And so the ranger actually recommended to me that I sing songs to myself. So I've been singing Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal.
Coming up on night number 4 here, I'm actually about 2 miles from the trailhead. I just got done eating about 1,500 calories worth of couscous. Still looking forward to that pizza tomorrow, though.
I made it back to so-called civilization the next day. The trip was a success, but I was definitely disturbed by how my thoughts quickly turned to pizza and pop music while out on the trail. Wilderness is wonderful, essential to the American landscape, but I find it difficult to make it my home, even for a short while. I don't know how George does it. I'm amazed by him and the 100 or so backcountry rangers in this country. To me, they're heroes who keep the light on for those of us who seek out the unknown in ourselves and in the world. And yes, the first place I went was a little pizzeria in a little one-stoplight town.
That story from independent producer Brad Horn. You're listening to Sidetrack. Pirates hold an enduring fascination. They're the subject of literature, trashy romances, and movies. Now, an exhibit at the Field Museum in Chicago seeks to demystify them. It provides historical perspective at a time when pirates are making the news again. Lynette Kulsness reports.
A class of fifth graders from Francis Xavier Ward School in Chicago is lined up, waiting impatiently. They're eager to see the exhibit, Real Pirates. It includes more than 200 artifacts like treasure and cannons from a sunken pirate ship.
I've been waiting for this for a long time.
That excitement spills over into their best guesses at how pirates talked.
Arg! Ahoy, matey!
I bet they swore a lot.
Yeah, I bet they swore a lot, too.
What else do you know about pirates?
They have peg legs and parrots.
The exhibit examines myths about pirates and takes a look at the golden age of piracy that ended nearly 3 centuries ago. A few surprises. Some pirates did have peg legs and eye patches. Hey, it was a dangerous job. Some had pets on board, like cats and dogs and, yes, parrots. But they didn't make people walk the plank.
It was kind of a lot of pomp and ceremony for something where they would have probably just thrown them overboard.
Tom Skorsky is a project manager for exhibitions at the field. He says it's important to look back because history can shed light on what's happening now.
Fact is, they still did kill people. They still did raid ships. And the difference between current pirates in Somalia and what these pirates were doing is not very different. Yet, for some reason, we have this romantic view of them through literature and popular culture.
The Somalis aren't the only ones attacking ships and holding crews and ships for ransom. But an agency that monitors piracy says more than a third of the attacks last year were off the coast of Somalia. Despite these modern-day attacks, pirates still have pop culture status that shows up in fashion like puffy shirts and meetup groups.
they say that the number two Halloween costume for adults is pirates. You know, the Treasure Island pirates, Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, they represent kind of this bad boy image of, you know, pirates. They did their own thing. They answered to no one. And so I think that there's something very appealing about that to people.
That romanticized view is why teacher Katie Lucas is here with her fifth graders.
They're already starting to make connections with novels and things we've read about slavery and pirates, and you're hearing them make connections with current events. So we're trying to sort of get the Hollywood out of that and make it more realistic to them.
Her students, Gordon Young and Matt Spector, look around with interest. They make immediate links with current events.
Yeah, it's cool to learn about pirates and exhibits, but if you really think about it, pirates are really bad people.
And how about today? Are there any pirates still today?
Yeah, they go on huge cruise ships and take things for ransom.
They're from a country, Somalia, that had a civil war and their government broke up.
Pirates now don't have, like, those pistols anymore. They are loaded with, like, the newest guns, like machine guns and AK-47s and that kind of stuff.
Another student, Raina Lee, is intrigued to learn that pirates voted on things.
They were kind of like us today. With our president, they voted for their captain, like we vote for our president and stuff.
But the most surprising discovery is a chest full of coins.
Why is it so oddly shaped?
Yeah. I always thought they looked like perfect coins.
Yeah.
The students learned that pirates didn't bury their treasure after all. Olivia Guida says it makes sense that they wore the coins as jewelry. She says she never really got the point of burying the treasure. I'm Lynette Kalsness.
Still to come, we talk to Joni Gruel Wanamaker, granddaughter of Raggedy Ann creator Johnny Gruel, about the closing of the Raggedy Ann and Andy Museum in Arcola. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. Is there such a thing as a recession-proof product in a downward-sliding economy? For three vets of the corporate world, they're hoping that product is cupcakes. They have recently opened a store called Butter Lane in New York's East Village. They think they have found the secret to building a better confection. It's somewhere between traditional Southern baking and the stylish sophistication all New Yorkers secretly crave. Independent producer Eric Winnick has more.
Sometimes you just want more. There's this set of circumstances called your life, and for most people, that's enough. For others, the idea of being only one thing is like being trapped in a room without doors or windows, even if you're good at that one thing. Knowing there's something else out there can drive you to some pretty unexpected ends, make you do things you didn't think you were capable of. When Maria, Pam, and Linda met, they had two things in common. They were all from the South, and they dreamed that someday they could work for themselves. Before long, they were talking about their grandmother's kitchens. That's what led to the cupcakes.
My name is Maria Baugh. I'm from Panama City, Florida, and I currently reside in Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan.
Maria Baugh is 45. During the week, she's the executive managing editor of Glamour magazine.
Linda Elizabeth Lee. I'm from Tallahassee, Florida originally, and I now live in Soho.
Linda Lee is also 45. Like Maria, her job keeps her busy during the week. She's a producer for the Food Network show, Chopped, and a former executive producer of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
Pamela Nelson. I grew up in Houston, Texas, and now I live in Tribeca, New York City.
At age 43, Pam Nelson was laid off by Citigroup, where she held the daunting title of Managing Editor, Portfolio Strategist, Global Research. This was in February 2008, when severance packages were still pretty generous. Most people in Pam's position might have looked for another job in the financial sector, but Pam had been talking to Linda and Maria. The three decided to join forces and do something unlike anything they'd done before, start a bakery. And not just any bakery, a cupcake emporium in the heart of New York City's East Village. If that sounds like a questionable move, you wouldn't be entirely wrong. New York's seen an influx of cupcake bakeries in recent years, spearheaded by the success of Magnolia in the West Village. But Maria, Pam, and Linda did their homework. According to Maria,
we love the East Village, first of all. It's just the grooviest part of town, I think. And it's a great demographic for, you know, a lot of, cupcakes, I think they appeal to the young, the old, everybody. But it does seem to be a group of people, 20s, 30s, who are really into cupcakes. And it's a young neighborhood here. It was not saturated with cupcake shops. That was a big business decision. The rents were not unreasonable compared to other locations. So all those things combined.
When it came time to pick a name, their inspiration came from a street in the Long Island town where they shared a summer home, Sagaponics Butter Lane. The only question was how to reflect this half-down-home Southern, half-Hamptons New York sensibility in both the store and the product. The answer was the frosting.
For example, like the cupcakes, we use a French buttercream in addition to an American buttercream. We have a little something extra, and we like to do that in the shop. We have a really beautiful wallpaper that was designed, hand-painted by Woo Kim. It's a little bit of a French feel. It's a little bit of just a simple sophistication that goes along with the sort of natural organicness of what we're doing with the cupcakes, I think.
The buttercream thing isn't just a gimmick. French uses granular sugar and egg whites. American uses confectioner sugar and butter, which makes sense for a store trying to meld Southern baking with recipes to suit a more sophisticated palate, otherwise known as...
less sugar, more flavor. I mean, that was the mantra that we just kept going back to over and over again in our recipes, is that you've got to get the sugar down and you have to bring the flavor up.
Pam Nelson.
So not only do we have less sugar in individual recipes, and we're bringing up the flavor with things like real vanilla bean, really high quality chocolate in our basic flavors, but we're also offering a whole bunch of different flavors. We offer coconut and peanut butter and grapefruit ginger and, you know, a lot of things that I'm almost surprised that people respond to.
Differentiating yourself in the market is important, but according to Maria, there's no substitute for having a solid business sense.
When you are putting your business plan together, before you really start, overestimate what those expenses might be, because especially if it's your first time and you're starting out, there are going to be expenses you never imagine, and so try to be ready for those and just add a nice cushion in, because you want to be prepared for things that you just in a million years could never imagine you were going to need to think about. They're going to cost money.
As intelligent as the business plan is, it's still a pretty tough time to be an entrepreneur. But that hasn't stopped people from making the occasional inquiry. Pam Nelson explains.
Most of the other people who were getting laid off at the same time who worked on Wall Street were immediately just trying to find a job that was similar. And they just said, you know, you're crazy to try and do the small business thing. It doesn't make any sense. And of course, now that Citibank stock is, you know, at $5 or less, you know, I have friends now coming to me and saying, this cupcake thing looks pretty good. You know, maybe this is something that we should explore.
Someone comes in the shop every day asking me, how did you do it?
Linda Lee.
It's always been my dream to do something like this. And can I do it? And yes, you can do it. I'll be honest, Pam getting laid off was an opportunity for us that I don't think, if we hadn't had that situation happen, we would still be having coffee and talking about it.
Pam Nelson.
I mean, I think, look at what's happened to our 401ks. I mean, that is what is so ironic about all this, is that this has turned out to be a much wiser decision, almost a more conservative decision than staying with a large company like Citibank. And I think what we're building here will end up being something that we're glad that we're in versus having a 401k. You have more control over it.
And who knows? Given what's going on out there, maybe we could use a few more cupcakes. Wishful thinking? Maria doesn't see it that way.
People, they're holding back on spending in other areas. Luxury has just, you know, taken a dive, luxury goods market. But for $250 or $275 for a cupcake that's, you know, made really well with really good ingredients, it's a little tiny, tiny luxury that people could still afford. And we thought maybe that would even, you know, be something that would help our business, that, you know, people could spend a little money here and get a, you know, something that tasted really good and was made really well.
In the end, whether Butter Lane turns out to be an alternative 401k or just a cozy place to spend a weekend, the proprietors agree that the bottom line is the product. It's what got them together in the first place, when their working lives seemed to be about one thing and one thing only. For all they agree on, however, there's one thing on which they may never find consensus.
I like the cupcake without the icing, which is weird because there's so many people who would just eat the icing.
Maybe chocolate on chocolate if I'm in a really chocolate mood.
I just had the chocolate cake with peanut butter frosting, and it was divine.
Ma chambre a la forme d'une cage. Le soleil passe son bras par la...
That story from Eric Winnick from the files of Yarn Audio Works. They can be found online at yarnaudioworks.com. You're listening to Sidetrack. Illinois has recently seen a surge of wine production, but is it on par with legendary wine regions elsewhere? AM 580 intern Whitney Wyckoff traveled to Vermilion County, where a part of the prairie has become a vineyard.
Hi there. Are you Don? Sleepy Creek Vineyards in Fairmont is a tiny winery owned and operated by Dawn Taylor and her husband Joe. In the front of their warm wooden barn, the Taylors have long tables set up for wine tasting. And in the back, they make wine from the grapes they grow on site. Their winery's 7 wines have farm-inspired names and labels, like Henpecked, which is a semi-sweet red made from Frontiac grapes. But neither Dawn nor Joe knew a thing about agriculture before starting out 6 years ago.
We decided to go ahead and give it a try and planted some vines, and they grew. So we planted some more vines and they grew, and we made some decent wine. So we went ahead and took our little hobby and expanded it to something hopefully was a successful business.
Dawn says at first, her neighbors were skeptical when she and her husband bought the unused piece of farmland where the winery now stands. When some found out that the Taylors were producing wine, they thought the couple was going to start a tavern and bring in so-called undesirables. In fact, the Taylors didn't realize until shortly after they bought the property that the township that they lived in was dry. So Joe says they needed to win over their neighbors.
That was grueling. Both Don and I are kind of shy people, and we had to go out just to get the issue on the ballot. We had to go out and collect signatures, and I think we collected like 700 signatures, I believe. And so we were going door to door, standing out in front of businesses, and it was just not only time-consuming, but extremely difficult for somebody that's not a real outgoing person and used to talking to strangers.
In roughly 10 years, Illinois has seen a surge of 144 new wineries, including Sleepy Creek. And University of Illinois wine specialist Bradley Beam says most of these wineries are mom-and-pop establishments.
Probably the lion's share of new winery owners and vineyard owners are retirees or people that are approaching retirement. And usually they come from all kinds of walks of life, teachers and lawyers and business, other business. So generally not from an agricultural background, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So all the ins and outs of growing a crop and producing wine have to be learned in a very short amount of time.
The Taylor's Winery, along with other wineries in the state, can't grow more commonly known wines like Chardonnay or Merlot. So they've had to research varieties that are more appropriate to the climate. About three-quarters of Illinois' wine industry is dominated by American and French hybrid grapes and a type of grape native to the United States.
Some people consider wine from Illinois not real wine. Some people used to consider wine from California not real wine because it's the new world of wine, and the old world would be, you know, Europe, where Italy and France and Germany, they've been doing wine for a lot longer than the New World because they've been in existence a lot longer.
The U of I's Beam says that 20 years ago, Illinois wines were unsophisticated. But now, with new grape varieties being introduced, Beam says that there have been improvements in quality and quantity. Winemaking is not a new phenomenon in Illinois. It's just making a comeback. It was introduced to the state by French settlers who set up camp in what is now Peoria. By 1900, Illinois was the fourth largest in wine production in the United States, but wineries took a hit during Prohibition in the 1920s. While some producers continued to grow grapes, most switched to more lucrative crops like corn or soybeans. Even when Prohibition was repealed, farmers mostly did not return to winemaking. That started changing in the 1990s. But even so, Illinois is in a different position than wine giants like California. Where California wine production grew into a worldwide phenomenon, Beam says not much Illinois wine gets shipped across state lines. What most wineries sell is the experience of wine tasting at a connection to what was produced in the state.
Our industry is very, very young, and that's one of the complaints I get from general wine consumers. That they go to a winery once, not real happy with the wine quality, never go back again. And most of our wineries start with very, very little experience and virtually no formal training. So there's a real learning curve involved in wine production. And so the wines that they're making in years one and two dramatically improve in years four, five, six.
Monty Python's John Cleese in the film Wine for the Confused says you need a big fortune to make a small fortune in wine. Dawn says this is the first year that they've been in the black. It takes a few years for vineyards to produce wine. While the two opened the winery a year and a half ago, the Taylors have been working 6 years to get their facility up and running. Three of those years before their wine could produce grapes, and another year to make wine. Despite the slumped economy, Dawn says that wine sales continue to increase slightly. After all, she says, wine does make life better. I'm Whitney Wyckoff, AM 580 News.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. If you're a fan of Raggedy Ann and Andy, you don't have much longer to visit their museum in Arcola. After 10 years, the museum is closing, with a majority of the collection being donated to the Strong National Museum of Play in New York. Joni Gruelle Wanamaker, daughter of Raggedy Ann creator Johnny Gruelle, and her husband Tom Wanamaker have been running the museum since the beginning, but feel it's time to move on. A couple of days ago, I talked with Joni Gruelle Wanamaker to learn more about the museum and their reason for closing.
Well, it's been coming on for a few years because in the last 5 years, the tourism has really dropped in the area. And also, Tom and I are getting older, and our family lives in Georgia. We moved up here from Georgia about 10 years ago to start the museum. And we have grandchildren down there, and of course, our kids are down there. And we got to the point where we were just, you know, this is our baby, this museum, and even though we only live about a block and a half away from here, we still worry about it, and it started to really consume us, so we have not been able to do the traveling to visit family that we'd like to do. And also we're getting, since we are getting older, we're just getting a little more tired, and since tourism has dropped, we've had to cover quite a few of the shortfall months over the years, and now with the economy the way it is, we're going into our retirement just too much, and we're just not able to do it anymore.
So when was the museum founded?
10 years ago. This will be our 10th anniversary this May.
And so it's going to be the 10th and presumably final year.
Yes.
Now, for those who don't know, tell us a little bit about the history of Raggedy Ann and her creator, which is your grandfather, Johnny Gruelle.
Well, Johnny was born here in 1880. He grew up in Indianapolis area, and when he married my grandmother, they eventually settled in Connecticut, and that's where Raggedy Ann, as we know her, was started. And she was, one reason why she was created was for my grandparents' first child and only daughter, Marcella. When Marcella was 13 years old, she was bedridden with a heart condition. She passed away a few months after that. But while she was sick, Johnny would make up stories to entertain her. And he would include her little dolls and her little playthings in his stories to entertain Marcella. And one of Marcella's little dolls was a doll that we very possibly could have been made right here in Arcola. We don't know for sure. But my great-grandparents settled here from Kentucky, so the doll could have been made in Kentucky for my great-grandmother Alice. And when Marcella was a little girl, it was just a little generic doll that was given to Marcella, and it was fixed up by the grandmothers in the family. In fact, my dad remembered the grandmothers sitting around and sewing the first little dolls that were made and fixing up this doll for Marcella. But this is the little doll that became the first Raggedy Ann. It did belong to Marcella. And when Marcella passed away, Johnny realized that these stories about Marcella and her adventures would really entertain children. And the family made the first dolls to give away. And when Johnny realized this was not only a way to remember Marcella, but also to feed the family, he decided to patent Raggedy Ann in 1915, and then in 1918, the first Raggedy Ann book and the first Raggedy Ann doll were produced commercially. And then a few years after that, the little brother Raggedy Andy came along. So that's how Raggedy Ann got started.
Hmm. Now, you're donating a majority of the collection to the Strong National Museum of Play in New York. Did you contact them, or did they contact you?
The lady that we consider our family biographer she's written educational books plus children's books. And one of her associates years ago is now the curator at the Strong Museum. So when Raggedy Ann and Andy got into the National Toy Hall of Fame, which is at the Strong Museum, we went up and went for Andy's induction 2 years ago, and we met these folks, and we saw this museum. And so we approached these people on the advice of Patricia Hall, who is the family biographer, and since she worked with some of these folks, she said this would. She recommended the Strong Museum. She said it's an incredible museum. It's also it's not only an interactive children's museum, but it's a research facility. And so she thought it would be a wonderful place for the family papers, and they will be able to do with the characters things that we are just unable to do because of space and money in Arcola.
Well, besides the museum, you guys also hosted the original Raggedy Ann and Andy Festival, which has been canceled this year. Was the reason behind that the same reason you're closing the museum?
No, the festival started about 20 years ago. That started before we knew anything about Arcola. So there were a couple of ladies in town that founded this festival back in the early 90s. And my husband Tom and I started to come up and I think it was 1996, and we fell in love with the area, and we were government employees in Atlanta, and we really wanted to get out of, we didn't want to leave our family, but we wanted to get out of the rat race of a city. So since we loved Arcola, it was Tom's idea to do a museum. The family had talked about it, and nothing had been done about it. So that's why we moved to Arcola. But the festival had already been going for quite some time. So the reason why there is not an organized festival this year is because the Chamber of Commerce, who sponsors it, just couldn't get anybody to be the chairman. So that's kind of sad, but there's still people that are going to be coming that had already made reservations. So there'll be something going during this particular festival time, just no organized festival. So that's kind of a heartbreak for us too, but we really didn't have anything to do with the festival.
Well, you know, nowadays toys are very flashy, both in design and, you know, they have electronic parts and connected to the web and all this stuff. And Raggedy Ann, though, is very unapologetically old-fashioned. She's very much a toy, a classic toy. Now, do you think this has contributed any to the downturn in the attendance at the museum?
I don't really think so, because over the years that Raggedy Ann and Andy have been around, her popularity has always been cyclical. During difficult times, Ann and Andy, there was always an upswing in the interest in Raggedy Ann and Andy, and I think she is a little bit old-fashioned, but I think there's we see it from we've had so many visitors from across the country and across the world that love Raggedy Ann and Andy and don't want to let these little dolls go. And I think you know, particularly right now when times are really tough for folks, and there is so much of this electronic, I call it garbage. It really isn't, but you know, it's overwhelming. I think kids glued in front of the internet for hours and hours. I think there's a lot of families that want to hold on to the tradition of these little dolls. They make people smile. We hear this over and over and over. The silly little red, white, and blue doll with the silly little smile on her face and the bright red hair and a heart that says, "I love you." She's always smiling. She's floppy. She's lovable. People can hug her. They can spill things on her, and she still has this silly little smile on her face. And I think people want to hold on to some of our American tradition. We're losing so much of it. They're very patriotic little dolls, so they're red, white, and blue. And I don't think Raggedy Ann's going to be going anywhere. I think a lot of these traditional things may be not quite as popular today, but I think they're going to be around for a long, long time.
So since the news has broke that you are closing the museum, what sort of reaction have you been getting?
It's been amazing. There was one little article in the Mattoon paper, and it's been picked up all over the place. We have had beautiful, beautiful letters. We've had emails. We've had telephone calls. We've had we've had the most kind comments, and we've had a lot of people come in since the news has been broken, and they're so worried they're not going to get down here before we close in December. And yeah, it's been really heartwarming for us, and it makes it even sadder for us that we have to do this. But I think we're making the right decision. I think Ann and Andy are going to find a wonderful home at the Strong Museum. It's an incredible interactive children's museum, and it's real bittersweet. You know, we're going to be happy to have our lives back, but yeah, it's very sad because this has been a baby for us. So, you know, that's the way that is.
Yeah. So what is life going to be like without the museum? Can you even think about it right now?
Oh, sure. Yes, we do. We think about it a lot. We used to be hikers and campers. We love animals. We have a house full of animals. We even have an animal, a Halloween, that lives in the museum, and one that lives in the office above the museum. So we'll be able to spend more time with our animals. We'll be able to visit our kids and our grandkids. Because this has been pretty much, even though we've had employees, this has been really a full-time thing for us, because when we're not here, we're worried about what's going on here. So we're looking forward to the day where we can relax a little bit.
So for those people who want to check out the museum before it closes, where are you located and what are your hours? And if you have a website, what's that?
We do. It's Raggedy Ann -museum.org. We have quite an extensive website. We have a lot of history. We have photographs of the museum. A lot of family information, and we are on the main street of Arcola. We don't have our museum sign out yet. We're going to wait until the end of the month, so people have to. You know, we're right on the main street, though, and we are open Tuesday through Saturday from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock. And Tom and I will be in the museum most of these days. One of us will be in here, and I love to sign books and love to sign dolls, and we give a little tour of the museum, and it'll only cost a dollar.
That was Joni Gurrell Wanamaker, who along with her husband Tom have been running the Raggedy Ann and Andy Museum in Arcola. Gurrell Wanamaker is currently asking people to send letters to the museum telling their stories about Raggedy Ann and Andy. For more information, call the museum at 217-268-4908. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. All the past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580 WILL Urbana.